Welcome to the Adotat Show, where the pixels meet the strategy in the great dance of digital advertising. Today, we're dialing into the frequency of Jeff Minsky, the mastermind weaving cross-media strategies into gold threads for Fortune 100 CMOs. Get ready for insights that zoom past the billboard and straight into the future, because when Jeff talks media innovation, the industry listens. Let's get the reel rolling.
Deserve to win when it matters most. Facing multi-billion dollar bet the company litigation? No problem. That's why we're here. Trackman Amin, LLP, is a true legal power.
Hey there, you've turned into the Adotat Show, where we strip down the ad world to its bare essentials. I'm your host, Pesach Latin, and today we've got the one and only Jeff Minsky stepping into the hot seat. We're peeling back the layers of digital ad universe, no holds bar. Ready for an uncensored dive? Let's get started. How are you doing, Jeff? And I mean beyond the just I survived another Zoom call marathon kind of well.
I am doing great. And first of all, thank you so much for having me. First of all, I've been wanting to have this conversation probably for over a decade with you. So it's a long time coming.
It's about ad tech, right? We're nothing personal that I need to shut down the recording, right?
Yeah, we're good. Ad tech.
Okay.
Not just ad tech, but the industry overall. Because I hate just
advertising, ad tech, marketing.
Yeah, I just going to that piece of ad tech that has been obviously incredibly important over the past few years, but we don't want to lose sight that ad tech is part of the advertising story. And I think that is also, especially these days, in terms of the world that we're moving into, is going to be an important perspective.
Okay, in the grand scheme of Jeff Minsky's life, if your career was a film genre, what are we talking here? A nail-biter thriller, an intellectual tech noir, or an unexpectedly funny comedy of errors? Are we expecting Oscars, or should we expect... Oscars or the Razzies?
Probably, depending on which part of my career you're talking about, a little of both. And I think everyone
right.
has that. You know, there are moments of Razzies, no question about it. There are moments of misplaced bets, or thinking the world's going to go one way, and then the world gets a pandemic and goes completely the other way. And then there are, you know, but I would like to think that my world has been one of a optimistic storyline, but with moments of absolute mystery and craziness and a little bit of Monty Python thrown in.
Can you give us the Reader's Digest version?
All right. So, you know, in terms of my life and my career.
Yeah.
So when I graduated,
if you were stuck in an elevator with Angelina Jolie,
I would not be talking. I'll be very clear on that. The Reader's Digest version of this, as I always said to various people throughout my career, when I graduated with an economics degree from Yeshiva University, I did not want to go to law school because I did not want to read contracts. I did not want to work till midnight, 2 a.m. every night, and I didn't want to have to do
right.
for a living. And so what have I done for the past 30 years? I've read contracts, I've negotiated, I've done pretty much everything I said I wouldn't do, and I've done
right.
joy because I really love this industry, and it is something that every single day, even though we all know there's a amount of craziness, it is a pleasure to be able to still be here and actively working in the advertising industry. So the Reader's Digest version is that I started out at a company called DeWitt Media, working for Dylan and Gene DeWitt, who was one of the first people to take media out of the full-service ad agency and go independent. And I had the pleasure of really getting a very strong traditional media background because it was print, television, out of home. I became the sort of designated out-of-home guy while I was there, in addition to planning print and TV. And I was privileged to, the first account, you'll appreciate this, the first account I worked on was Heber National. And I was one of the clients of the buying guidelines that they could not run spots from sundown Friday to sundown Saturday. And then every
day
I'd come in and I'd look at the record as to when spots ran, and at least 20 to 30% of the spots ran on Saturday. And so we had so many bonus units and free things. They loved it. It was like, all right, fine, great, awesome. So,
that's funny.
And of course, Supernatural was a bunch of Irish guys. So I worked on Supernatural, Reebok, MasterCard. And MasterCard was actually sort of a turning point in my career. First of all, it was a lot of fun. I had, at the time, just phenomenal clients. And we were working on the World Cup. I think he did 94 campaigns. So the World Cup 94, which was in the U.S. I plan a whole thing at all line markets with out-of-home banners. These really fun, just incredibly like big, bright banners with a World Cup mascot and with a MasterCard logo in nine cities. And my client decided that she wanted to go ride around in a convertible for 3 days in L.A. and make sure that we got every one of the 976 banners that we bought. And trust me, I will never forget that we purchased 976 banners. Those are physical banners, not digital. And, you know, so, yeah, we ride around, we count them, it's great. I am spending the weekend at a friend's house there. I walk into her house and her brothers are watching the NBA playoffs. And they interrupt the NBA playoffs because there's a white Bronco driving down the highway. And I'm the only one in America shouting, make a left, so my banners get national TV exposure. So, yes.
And, but he didn't. That was the he didn't make a left. He kept them going straight.
Yeah, he kept them going straight. Yeah, so
that's a funny reference.
Yeah,
that's a clip right there.
There you go. It was really just a wonderful time. The reason MasterCard was such a turning point is because they gave me the assignment. They got very curious about Bernie, about this thing called online services. Prodigy,
right?
You know, I think Prodigy was number one, CompuServe number two, and this startup called America Online had just kicked off.
Yeah, it's about right.
Yeah, and I was absolutely. You know, kicking with a medium. And because remember, this is back in dial-up days. So there was no streaming audio, streaming video. At the moment, if you were engaged in content or chat or whatever it was, you had to have your eyes glued to the screen. Engagement questions were not an issue. You were engaged. Mm-hmm. You were on digital at that point in time. And so that's when I sort of caught the bug. Then I moved to Ogilvy in 94. A friend of mine told me there was a role in their non-traditional media group, and IBM had just consolidated all of their business into Ogilvy. So I took that role, and knowing that IBM would be one of the probably bigger spenders on digital at the time. So part of my job, as I mentioned before, that I was sort of out-of-home expert. Half of it was out-of-home, half of it was digital. And in the first year, I remember the whopping spend that IBM was putting into digital was $150,000. And then, of course, the next 3 years, myself and Susan Cheekhawker, who now leads digital investment over at GroupM, she and I co-founded Ogilvy's digital media team. And we were able to get that $150,000 up to $30 million within that 3 years. And so that, you know, was a fun time. We weren't really worried about, we worried about metrics, but we weren't worried about, you know, making sure that every single banner generated SROI. It was sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy for IBM because the more content they were supporting, the more people would come onto the internet. The more people that came onto the internet, the more servers that those publishers would need to buy. And so for them to help seed the market was a strong strategy. So after Ogilvy, was there for about 6 years. And then in 2000, moved over to Wrap Digital, which then in 2002 formed into OMD Digital. And OMD Digital East for many years. And then went national, becoming sort of the emerging media dude because of my passion for technology and how it impacts marketing. So ran emerging media at Omnicom Media Group and strategy at OMD for about 15 years in total. And at the time, incubated the broadband teams, the mobile teams, the social teams, the digital out-of-home teams. And then, of course, the end of my tenure there went over. It was incubating advanced television and addressable TV and OTT and CT that the world talking about today.
So are you telling me you've been doing this a long time?
Well, no. I'm 18. Wait a minute, I'm 18. I've been doing it for a while. And what
You're known, I think, for having a keen eye for BS, right? In a world where every new gadget is hyped as a second coming, how do you dodge the duds and the spotlight and know what the real game changers are? What's the Minsky method?
Well, okay, Minsky method number one was, and this is a hard rule, if it doesn't work on my computer, then it doesn't work. And I've had numerous technologies of people coming to pitch me over the years where they want to show me a demo. And I say, okay, I'm trying it on my computer. And, I tend to have not the highest always end computer because it's still subject to whatever the corporate IT happens to be working with. But I have it high enough to where if it's not working for me, then it's not working at all. In fact, I remember Rob Glazer, remember Rob from Progressive Networks before it became Real Networks, when, you know, he basically was the father of streaming audio. I remember he came into my office and was trying to demo streaming audio at one point, and it just wasn't working. And so for a few years, I'm like, look, it's not going to scale if it's not working on my laptop. So that's one of my meters there. The other thing is, you know, if there's there are a lot of technologies that are very much aspirational and work, but the marketplace cost is so prohibitively expensive that it won't scale. And this was true. We did some tests back in, let's call it 2010-ish, I think, where we had a group of marketers coming together, including McDonald's and FedEx America and Cody and a few others. Because what I wanted to do when I was at Omnicom was sort of help avoid the mistakes of the early stage of the internet. And the early stage of the internet, there was a lot of, you know, handshake golf course deals that got us called and basically fixed more than about close to 10 bad AOL deals that have been done thanks to that. And so we wanted to say, look, we love moving forward and we want to see technology and the impact of it in house and crew marketers opportunities, but let's do some testing and see if the delta between what we currently have and what is coming, not only is it large enough to maybe warrant our attention, but do the economics work? If it's being priced at 10 times what your current borderline is, what your current parameters are, and yet the impact is only 2 times as great, well, okay, we'll keep an eye on it, but we're not going to, you know, move forward and go too deep into it. So that was, you know, that's part of the other thing I look at is, in looking at, sorry, I need to get some camera issues, so give me a second. Let it out. Okay, I hit it. We should be fine. So, you know, so we look at VR, and I love VR. Personally, I am a huge enthusiast on virtual reality because, as a gamer, you know, the fact that I can be in the game is amazing. But I'm not even talking it. VR is only gaming. I think that's part of the challenge it has. Is that the true use case of connecting people globally has not been fully explained or marketed well. So I, during the pandemic, was playing ping pong with friends of mine in Israel. Or I was, you know, talking to colleagues who also have a VR headset in London. And so, and when I say talking, it wasn't this. And as much as I appreciate seeing your face and looking at you with Zoom, we still have the camera issues. Where am I looking at the picture on my screen, or am I looking at the camera if I have more of a straight look? You know, when you're in VR world, I'm looking you in the eye, any virtual eyes. Now, clearly.
The virtual eye.
Yeah. And so clearly.
So, but in the buffet of marketing and tech, what is one dish that you wish you had your name on?
In the buffet of marketing and tech, what's the one dish that I wish I had my name on? Interesting.
Everyone has a tech crush.
Now in the future.
In the past.
All right. So I guess the way to put this is my biggest mistake. When I was with Ogilvy and IBM, we did, you know, again, early days, we roadblocked every search engine out there. We basically bought out every tech term that you could. And at the time, it wasn't an auction-based model for text links or whatever. It was literally, you type in the word laptop and a banner would come up based on the keyword you were searching. And we literally blocked out every potential technology term for 3 years across 12 different search engines. And
right.
So after doing that, I guess 6 months after we did that, this guy who I knew who had been a sales guy over at Big Yellow, which is one of the first kind of online yellow page directory terms. This guy's name was Tim something. Okay, Tim Armstrong. That was his name.
I remember Big Yellow and Tim for some reason. It sounded really familiar.
So obviously Tim became the big wig over at Google. So Tim comes over to me and says, Jeff, I've got this great new search engine to show you. I'm like, Jim, I just basically locked out 13 different search engines globally. They already tell me about it. He goes, all the results are ads. I'm like, and is it auction-based thing? I'm like, well, who in the world would want a search engine where all the...
Right.
And it's like, see you later. That was my biggest mistake. So what would I like to have done is go back and go, not only would I have my name associated, but I would have also taken every cent that I own and put it into Google stock after that. But yeah, so that would be the one. But look, going forward, I hope that between AI and VR, that's what I'm focusing on. But the other thing is, before we even get to VR, and it's one of the things that just shocks me, every single step of the digital era has been marked by the leaps in bandwidth that consumers have been able to enjoy. Fortunately for us as a society, every few years, bandwidth has increased exponentially. And we see we can trace it back from text to GIFs to rich media to streaming audio, streaming video, and it is all precipitated by a leap in bandwidth. And here we are in 2024 with the average
consumer. Is this Minsky's law?
I don't want to call it a law, but hypothesis. I'm not, my ego is not authentic. Okay. I don't want to call it law. But you can look at it. You just look at the time. We're at 5G, 8%. The average consumer left during COVID from, let's call it 150 meg now to about 300 meg now on average. But many of us have gig per second. And, you know, now you see marketing to consumers on 2 gig per second and even faster. So the question is, why, for the most part, have we not seen a change in how we engage and how we see and what we're looking at on how we engage with each other through digital, how we shop through digital? And the one area that I've been really focused on that I'm just waiting to see leap forward is e-commerce. You know, e-commerce, or you can't say social commerce and stuff like that. 3D digital twins, ELTF files, codified by the Kronos Group a couple of years ago. So just like you have JPEG for photos, there's GLTF for 3D digital twins, 3D renders. I can't imagine why we're not seeing every e-commerce store converting their 2D photos into 3D digital renders right now. And that's a step before we go into VR. That's a step before that's done on a 2D screen. But for me,
do you really think this would be like a complete overhaul in consumer engagement?
I believe that every time I've shown a 3D digital render to my wife or her friends, absolutely, that's exactly how I want to shop. I'm able to look at the product, zoom in with perfect clarity, turn it up, turn it down. You know, I have a daughter. One of my daughters has some pretty severe food allergies. And for me to be able to look at the label online, just as I would be able to look at it on at a grocery store, that to me is...
Don't worry, that's just the Matrix collection.
No, that was my crappy talent. I do need a nightmare one. So if I have to hit it again, I'll let you know. But yeah, so to me, what I would love to have my name on is, again, helping marketers see what the future pretends, not necessarily in 5 years, not in 10 years, but today. Also, sort of rewriting, you know, part of the barrier to that is legacy rules, and we've seen this again with every step of the digital era. And that is, you know, e-commerce teams have been said, you cannot do anything that will impact the store. You cannot do anything that will slow down the commerce, which is part of the reason GLTFs, they're bigger files, that they haven't been completely adopted. Well, my answer to that is we'd still be using text then. If no one's willing to step up and say, yes, we understand consumer bandwidth has changed, and therefore we have more flexibility to offer consumers something that is valuable to them, that actually will help improve their ability to be a consumer, I think that's a shame on us for not allowing or dictating to the e-commerce team that you can be more flexible than you have been.
So in the world of AI, where do humans fit? For example, Siri can't pick a good wine to save his life.
You know, the initial digital assistant, Siri, Alexa, and I have to be careful because I've got something here if I say it, it's going to go on. Happened the other day. And the Google one, basically...
Hey, Google.
Yes, it lit up. Thank you. Thank you. Now it's off. Okay. Now it's off. So they're dumb assistants. I mean, that will change by the end of this year, I think. I think they'll all be upgraded to be real, you know, conversational AI. But, you know, the AI world, you know, it's just like that story, what was it called? Schrodinger's cat. It all depends on how we end up receiving it. There's another story I know that you're familiar with, but I'm not going to go into that one. But the camera again. There we go.
Just slap it.
To answer your question, hold on, give me 1 second.
Reflecting on some projects you spearheaded, which one made you go, damn, we're onto something epic making here?
I think it has to be looked at on, not necessarily as one client or one thing that we did, I mean, clearly, as I already mentioned, the search thing was groundbreaking, but I think just building out Only Digital in the heart of the digital age and working right. with my good friend and someone who I miss greatly, Sean Finnegan, it was really...
Who died last year.
Yeah. That's way last year. And I think that, you know, building that, building OMD Digital up and seeding digital through an organization as, you know, as large as OMD and Omnicom Media Group and being there as a resource. And I will also say transitioning the traditional linear television team into advanced television thinkers and buyers.
Right.
One of the things I was proud of. A lot of other agencies were very much basically hiring either putting it all in the digital realm or hiring specialists and growing specialist teams for advanced television. And, you know, my perception is, you know, you've got to be sort of open and loyal to the people in your organization who have spent their careers and provided you with benefits throughout their career. And so upskilling them with the opportunities to be able to also buy digital television, OTT, and that type of thing is one of the things that I'm definitely most proud of. In terms of, I think another thing is, probably gaming. You know, Omnicom Media Group or OMD was one of the first agencies for many years to have a gaming division. That was spearheaded by somebody who I brought in, Dario Ricciuti. Dario had worked with me at Ogilvy, and I knew he had a passion for gaming, and so we brought him in. And thanks mostly to his efforts, and I want to give him the credit, he ended up building that and spinning it off into a P&L that is now Zero Code, which is still, I think, one of the most successful organizations in helping marketers integrate into games and coming up with gaming. I think, and I'm not a positive, but I believe there was a movie recently about a car racer who had won the opportunity to, he was a video gamer, who won the opportunity to race and then had one of the lawns on which race it was, I forget, but it was a Nissan promotion. And I think Dario was the one that actually had the idea for that, and I always saw teasing him. I'm like, are you in the movie? Anyhow, one of those things that I go, you know, we know there are captive audiences in gaming. Why is everybody ignoring it? And why are people not on to it? And that was another thing that I'm very proud of. But again, it's really good story.
Is there any ethical brain teaser that keeps you up staring at the ceiling at night, apart from caffeine overdoses?
Ethical brain teasers that keep me up at night. Look, I have been the quasi-contrarian for years on the cookie. I'm probably one of you that is jumping up and down that cookie is being deprecated. And that we're
are you the enfant terrible of the ad industry?
Well, of course the organization did, of course, to get banned or to be deprecated. You know, and so the various market forces that are out there that have now brought us to this moment where we are going to have to find new ways to use digital as a medium, and we will be able to use digital as a medium, but do it in a way that is far more respectful than we have been to consumers. But from the very beginning, all we really had to do was say clean. And I still don't understand why in the world we did. And I mean, I understand the economic major, I know the economic incentive for there not to. But the idea now that we are going to a world where we're going to have to say please, where first party data is going to be much more important, and even zero party data where we incentivize people to say please. But, you know, I think that's what keeps me up at night ethically. The other thing that keeps me up at night, not ethically, but just keeps me up at night, is the idea of the value proposition changing in advertising.
Right. Well, thank you for not talking about your prostate. I appreciate that.
We can. No. And that's not ethical. That's just, you know, life. But the other part that keeps me up at night is this idea that of supply and demand. Again, I'm going to probably say it too many times because I was not a very good economics major, but I was an economics major. And the explosion of content over the years, and not just the explosion of the premium content that we've come to know, but we've now moved into an era, which I think is a good thing, where marketers are understanding that not everything has to be produced publicly and with A-list talent to be valuable to advertisers. And so we moved into an era where there is a little bit more flexibility in where marketers will advertise, and that's grown the pool of supply even more. Challenges, the pool of demand, while maybe it's grown a little bit, hasn't grown at the same rate. And frankly, it jumped during COVID because people needed things to do, so they were hungry for content. But now that we're, let's call it, quasi-normalized back into society, it's not the demand curve is not jumping as much because we're back at work, we're back commuting. And so there's a lot of different factors that are tempering that demand a little bit. what happens when you have a supply curve jump in a demand curve stay basically where it is, the value of that subsidy that we've been getting, of the advertising subsidy that says you'll get free content in return for your attention, goes down. And I think that's where, you know, where I think the idea of the retail media is sort of stepping in and will hopefully at one point provide a little bit of a harder subsidy for that data. I think that's what's keeping me up at night. What's going to replace the subsidy? And I think that is something that everyone should be looking at, because if you want me to really care about advertising more than I do is in the industry, you need to provide a value exchange. And I don't think the value exchange is nearly as strong as it is.
So if I had to hand out, where would we find you? Would we be bartending on a tropical island or what? And I, you know, as a note, I would go visit you on that island in that bar.
Oh, thank you, thank you. You know, I actually, ironically, I'd be qualified because I actually took a course that I always say I graduated Columbia for $85. So once right. I took a mixology class at Columbia University, and I don't know where it is. I usually have the I usually have it up here somewhere. The certificate. Right. So I got a degree from Columbia.
Is that your most prized degree?
No, not my most prized degree. But it's something that would enable me to bartend in the Bahamas at, you know, at some point. Now, if ad tech went away today, I would still be in advertising. Like I said, ad tech is a quirk of advertising. It's not the entirety of advertising. But it is, you know, I think that especially, and I'd like to get back for a second, and you can cut this whatever you want, but I want to get back for a second because I never finished the answer about AI in terms of how AI.
Oh, yeah. I want to go more about AI, AR, and VR too, but go ahead, AI.
Okay, well sorry. I said it like short answer's cat and how it depends on where I'm seeing it. But I think I don't fear it as an overlord. I think that society will figure that out to a certain extent at least. What I view it as is a really interesting partner right now that is acting like a 3-year-old at the kernel. And I think that's what we have to keep in mind is that, I've spoken a lot, taught some classes on this, and there is some incredible things, in particular for creatives in our industry, that are going to, and people who are creative types that just didn't have the technical skills at City of Creative will now be able to lean in and be creative thanks to AI. So I think the opportunities for us to create some wonderful content, meeting objectives, and not just relying on automation is going to be there. What I worry about, and it is, this goes into sort of your question on not ethics as much, but one of the things that keeps me up at night is the impact of garbage in, garbage out on AI. And AI is only as good as the data you train it on. And already over the past couple of months, we've been seeing some stories in the marketplace about the fact is that we're running out of good data to train it on. And good data means smart, intelligent, accurate data. So what's left? What's left is the masses, and, you know, you have to question a lot of what's going in there, and, you know, there are some challenges. I posted this on Facebook, you may have seen this.
Were you the one that said garbage in, garbage out today? Because I actually read that today.
I don't know if I said it today, I've been saying it for a while. And I think anybody who has been saying it for a while, I mean, anybody who knows anything about software has been saying
right.
that.
Obviously it's garbage in. Look at Grok. Grok has become racist.
Okay, thank you. That's where I was going with this. Now, I'm not sure if you and I are talking about the same Grok. There are two Groks. There's the X Grok, and then there's another company, GROQ, of Grok, and that's the one
I was talking about Elmo, Elon, okay. Sorry.
Okay, so the Grok I'm talking about is not the one from X. It's the other one.
And, is it more or less racist?
Well, again, let me explain you a story, because I think you'll see where his knee-jerk reaction was a little bit, was anti-Semitic, but right. Then it corrected itself. But I'll explain, let me explain that. So I basically will just play around with this new AI, new model, which is supposedly really running on incredibly fast hardware, and it's called Grok GROQ, and it's fast. There's no question. It returns your answers very, very quickly. I asked it just because it had been a topic I was thinking about that day in terms of what are the origins of anti-Semitism. And it gave me some, you know, a well thought out answer going back through the ages. And it quoted this Greek philosopher, and I'm going to screw up his name if I don't look it up, like Herodotus or Iodotus or something like that. I'll look it up at some point. And it basically said that he said that, you know, let me look up the quote very quickly because I want to get the quote correctly. You could edit my while you're doing it, so I give you a topic. Never mind. Oh, it's that. So, Hecateus of Abdera. And the answer was that in the ancient world, anti-Semitism has its roots in ancient times dating back to the 3rd century. For example, the Egyptians blamed the Jews for the economic and social problems in their society. And the Greek historian Hecateus of Abdera wrote that the Jews were a misanthropic and barbarous race. So here's the thing. I said, okay, can you source that for me? Where is your source? So let me read you this answer. I apologize, but I cannot source that quote as it is not accurate. In the case of Abner did not write anything about the Jews being a misanthropic and barbarous race. He was a Greek historian who lived in the 4th century BCE. While he did write about the Jews, there is no record of him referring to them as a misanthropic and barbarous race. And so,
well, I stopped using AI for most of my research, especially when it comes to Gemara, because it will tell me something like, it says, the Rambam says this. I'll say, I need like 5 sources. And then I'll ask the AI, that doesn't sound right. They're like, well, we just made this up. I mean, the AI has said that to me. I just made this up based on something I read. I'm like, but I asked you for accurate sources.
Certain polling companies, and I won't name them, have announced an issue spending anywhere between 100 million and up. Some have said 300 million, over 300 million over the course of the next 3 years on AI. And those are agencies. Now, think about bigger companies who are using AI for mission-critical decisions. Now, I think it will get there. Don't get me wrong. I think it will get there. They'll figure that an AI truly is going to change our lives.
You have to have a person monitoring it. I think it just like any other job where you have supervisors and you have workers, it's going to be no different. And that's how I use my AI. My AI is like an assistant I don't have anymore because I don't live in New York anymore. I don't need a full-time assistant. So I use the AI for basic research. Now that's what it helps. It saves me a lot of time, especially I rewrite a lot of the questions. And so instead of having, you know, Sean's name on this, I just had it rewrite with Jeff. You know, and it made it much easier than me because I don't want to make the mistake of, you know, saying someone else's name.
100%.
So I have a question moving forward. So do you see AR? I want to move to AR and VR. Do you see it taking us to the next marketing sphere? Are we gearing up for a world where we try and virtual close doesn't mean avoiding the fitting room?
So I think that eventually AR will find its place. There was a lot of excitement around AR in particular when COVID came out a few years ago, and it was because of scale. You know, everybody was in the park with each other, got outside. It was great.
They have other Go now. They have Monopoly Go. They had one for the Harry Potter world, the world of Wizarding and stuff.
Yep. And Niantic has been doing some really interesting things. Unfortunately, nothing seems to scale to the level of Pokemon Go. And I love their stuff, but I think that there's some marketing that they have to do to explain to consumers what the fun, you know, where the payout is. And again, what is that value exchange? But I think AR, what excites me right now is the Ray-Ban Meta glasses, because you can see the next evolution when they get to that point of something fashionable.
Instead of the big headsets.
Right. Well, for AR. And I'm talking consumers, I'm not talking enterprise. For enterprise, AR is already doing incredible things from development, from prototyping, from store visualizations, and for research and testing. So AR and VR are doing some incredible things in that space already, and that doesn't get spoken about enough. And so everybody in a B2C world goes, hey, it's not scaling, it's huge, isn't it? It will get there. It is already, I think, from a mixed reality, because I think the line between AR and VR is slowly merging and blurring. So they're the mixed reality headsets. The Quest 3 has sold well. You know, its price point is still a big challenge. And I think, obviously, the Vision Pro, which, you know, anything that Apple comes out with is immediately getting the super hype. It's a beautiful device. It's an incredible device. And it's far too expensive to ever scale. So it's more of an enterprise thing and for the trade. But when it comes down to VR headsets, you know, I spent a lot of time in my Quest 2, starting to spend some time in the Quest 3. And what I've recognized is that in the metaverse, the Horizon Worlds, or whatever you want to call what Zuckerberg has created as a social area in VR, it has gotten more crowded. It's not crowded. It is not scaled to millions of people per day, but it's growing. And so when you walk in, you will see other people. But that's such a small part of what you can do as a marketer in the VR world. You know, when the metaverse hype was there, I'm sorry, I switched a little bit to metaverse, but it all goes into...
It's all the same. It's just... Right. So when the metaverse...
I had major issues a couple of years ago when metaverse was the big hype, because people started, you know, renaming games like Roblox or Minecraft or
I've argued that Roblox, Minecraft and Fortnite are just extensions of the metaverse, what you know, or early metaverse experiments.
Yes, but what I was a little bit more down on was the fact that they were, my big issue was all the marketers, in particular luxury marketers, that were jumping into Roblox. And I'm sitting here going, what the?
Because every 12-year-old needs a pair of Christian Louboutin shoes, right?
Absolutely. And part of the issue there, and this is an issue for the industry, and it goes back into sort of your question before about what keeps me up at night, You know, we are supposedly the most data-rich media world that has ever existed. And yet, unless things have changed dramatically since I left the agency side, but according to my contact at the agency side, it hasn't. Between Comscore and Nielsen, there are still not a good tool out there to be able to run quintile analysis. And for those of you who aren't familiar with quintile analysis, it basically breaks your audience into 20% segments of heaviest user to lightest user. And so anybody that could do, I believe, and I have not seen this done, so I don't want to be misquoted here or taken out of context, but I believe that if you were to do the quantile analysis on something like a Roblox or a Fortnite or whatever, Minecraft, you would say the top two, the heaviest user quintile is probably under 12. So they may have a
range. 12 to 14, 10 to 14, yeah, 100% it is.
Right,
but I think Roblox knows that. So, do you think that brands should be about making a splash, or should they get into the pond smoothly?
Depends on the brand, depends on the marketing objective is. So, I can't answer that. There are plenty of brands that would benefit from doing more brand stuff and not worrying so much about the immediate ROI. Again, as somebody who came from the background of brand advertising, you know, Ogilvy, the Mather at the time, was the leading agency for we did brand prints. It was all about brand. And Ogilvy One, which was where digital started, was in fact DR, but I would call Ogilvy One sort of DR light, bottom feeding, chain smoking, how cheap can I get type of a hung DR child. I think it was
what excites you the most in VR and AR?
What excites me the
most? Virtual try-ons to immersive brand experiences, what excites you the most?
Globalization. The ability to reach global audiences in a personal way, to be able to speak to them as humans. What excites me the most is, again, the complete immersive experience. So if you're going to force digital, and this is what I was saying before, if you're going to force digital to be more of a sales channel and then do your ROI on how much did this sell, then at least make it as immersive in real life as humanly possible. And I think
is there one case that you can say this is what the future marketing should look like?
Not yet. There hasn't.
No, not yet. There's nothing you're like, this is amazing. Like some of the stuff in Times Square, the AR experiences.
No, from AR experiences. Okay. Yeah. I mean, look, yes, some of the stuff has been done, but the problem is that some of these days in terms of matching, I think matching out of home with AR is a natural. And again, coming through with that and those, it's bringing a billboard to life is just an incredible experience. So yes, of course, all of those have been, those executions have been interesting, but they all scale. Because not everybody in the world is going to click on that QR code and bring it out there. It's a great way to win an entry into some sort of award show and say, look at the great potential that we've done. So from an AI perspective, I think Coca-Cola did an amazing job in there. I think it's called Masterpieces, and where they used AI to create this incredible, I think it was over a minute, I don't remember the time frame on it, but experience where they brought paintings in a museum to life in a way that just really exemplified what Coca-Cola is. And the creativity and especially their nice little audio they had. I think audio is another big part, and surround audio is another big part of what we're looking at in terms of the future. Really, maybe what grab a hook, and that's what advertising should do. If you want to buy the product. And so using AI as a partner, being immersive, the VR experiences that I've seen to date, have been a little bit more on the entertainment side. So things have been done, like with Stranger Things right now, that's a great game on Quest.
Yeah, right.
Time to do it right. Whereas Ghostbusters has not actually, that's sort of a tired franchise that they're trying to bring back. But the Ghostbusters game had a lot of excitement at announcement, but didn't fulfill its promise. It was okay. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't great. So I think there's still people. Yeah, I will tell you one of the best things, that it was a few years ago in VR, when Elton John announced his final tour, there was this phenomenal experience that was created where you were taken into this really very Elton John-esque world through a medley of his hits. But you were, you're by Albert Brook Road, you're walking down the Albert Road, and then you're Rocket Man, you were up in space. That was, to me, exemplify what brands should look at doing. Take what cannot be done in a 2D environment. Take what your brand is all about, match it together, and go crazy. And I think that's one of the exciting things about both AR and VR.
What's the most out there theory that you believe in? Is it aliens running the ad industry, or a coffee that's a direct portal to genius?
The coffee that's a direct portal to genius? Is that what you said?
Yeah. What's a conspiracy theory you believe in?
This is where we have practical futurists by not believing in conspiracy theories. The one I will say I believe in. And it's not a conspiracy theory, it's just a fact. And that is that, the advertising world, in particular the advertising world of the holding company owned agencies. And God love them. I love the people there. I want to be very clear on that. And right. Even the senior management, who I count a number of them as friends, and I know the challenges that they have to go through. So it's not on the individual. But our industry has really become the equivalent of an HMO. And that is, we haven't, no, I truly believe that. In order to serve both Wall Street and your client, you can't prescribe things, you can't recommend things that are bad, of course, that would not ever fly because you'll lose your clients. But you also can't necessarily recommend the optimal media plan for a client, because at the end of the day, you've cut some very large deals with some very large people that have to be fulfilled, where the clients benefit. And maybe they're not benefiting that everything is tailored to them. And so I very much view it as sort of like an HMO. Doctors may want to prescribe something, but they really can't because the HMO won't allow them to. They're not going to harm the patient. They're going to try and help the patient as much as they can given the parameters, but they're not giving full autonomy to do what's absolutely 100% right for the client or for the patient. And so I think that's the conspiracy theory, or to call it conspiracy theory, that also subscribed to.
Is there a leap of faith that you're most proud of taking? And skydiving with clients does account, unless it was literal.
Look, I am married to a wonderful woman.
Right.
I have three.
And that was a leap of faith? You tell her that?
It's a huge leap of faith. Trust me. Well, right. You're going to find out why in a second. I met my wife online. I went before there was JDate, before there were dating sites, Jewish singles on AOL chat. So that's the leap.
And I want to make this clear. You have met her since then.
Yes. I believe that she's the same one I was talking to initially. Yes. So yes.
Okay.
That's my leap of faith.
What's one piece of advice that's been your North Star?
It's only advertising. I mean,
really?
My piece of advice, I don't know if anyone gave me a piece of advice that I could point to and say, okay, this was it. I know that when I first started in advertising and I was looking to get a job in advertising, a recruiter told me three things. Don't work on a movie account because they switch release dates all the time and it's a mess. Don't work on an airline account because at the time during the fair wars, things were changing every day. And I guess I could say it now. Whatever you do, don't work at gray. Advertising, that was their advice.
Don't work at gray. Well, I will tell. I just spoke to Sean an hour ago. I'll tell him that.
So, well, that's what the recruiter told me at the time, not now. At the time, gray was known as the hard place to be, and it was not the best place in the world. But
when was this, in the 90s?
I hate to say it, but it was actually the end of the 80s. So, yeah. But
what keeps your passion burning, though? What keeps your passion burning? Industry is perpetually on fast forward. Do you have a Minsky motivational mixtape?
Yeah. I mean, what keeps my passion burning is seeing the great creative work that gets done. Seeing that because of my passion for technology, and that the technology has not slowed down. Yeah, COVID put it on hold longer because of the supply chain issues. So some of the hardware issues that have impacted us over the past few years and have finally faded means that we're going to start seeing more catching up now. But there's never a day where there's not something new to look at, when there's not a new player in the market, where there's not somebody launching a new software or a new ad tech or a new hardware device. I mean, look at CES this year. I've been to CES minus 1 or 2 years during COVID for about 25 years straight. And this year, I was as energized as ever seeing what came out. And what was one of the number one things buzzed about? And a device called the Rabbit, which probably should be renamed for reasons I'm not going to go into. But it is a AI standalone device that will integrate with your apps. So if you say to the device, hey, I want to buy movie tickets for the 3D screening of Dune at the AMC Essex Green, you don't have to go and open AMC Movie Watcher or Fandango or whatever, it'll just do it for you. And so I think that standalone device clearly in one form will be eaten up into a phone of some sort.
Right.
But that device is one of the potential game changers for our, or that what the passive of what that device does, is a game changer for marketing, for marketers. And I think that's what gets me going. It's like, you know what? Being a futurist, a practical futurist, not just bringing it out what's going to happen in 10 years and 20 years, but looking at what's literally around the corner is what keeps me excited and what makes me want to continue to serve marketers with advice and intelligence in this industry.
And moving on to something a little bit more serious, let's face it, the ad world is a media circus, aren't immune to the old demons of anti-Semitism. It's high time we shine a spotlight on this ugly underbelly with a no-holds-barred discussion. Since both Jeff and I are members of the tribe, who better to tackle this elephant in the room? Jeff, anti-Semitism in the workplace is like that awkward family dinner topic everyone dodges. But here we are, two Jews ready to go there. What's your take on anti-Semitic undercurrents in our industry? How have you seen this play out? And more importantly, what is your game plan for showing it the door?
Oh, God, I hope I'm not the only one that's going to show the door, because one individual, unfortunately, can't, and it's really going to dig all of us. You know, as I said before when we were talking about AI, the more that we get impacted as an industry by AI, the more I'm worried about some of the undercurrents that are embedded into AI with anti-Semitism. Now, again,
just reflecting the reality of people and their perceptions?
Well, look, let me say this way. Yes, it's also reflecting the data that AI is trained on. So AI is trained on data created by people, but it depends on what the people who train the AI are doing to putting parameters in and what data they're giving it. Let me just say this. We are a wonderful industry. We're a wonderful industry that has been open, that has done a lot of improvement over the past decade. I want to give a shout out to Media Village and Jack Myers, who has been in the forefront of advancing diversity for many, many, many years. We are not, every industry has different biases and hold that cultural and diversity challenges that they have to tackle. So this is not something that is only about the ad industry. And I want to be very clear that in many ways, the ad industry industries are far worse than the advertising industry in terms of but that doesn't mean that it hasn't happened. I've had brushes with it in my career.
Can you give us the gritty details and how you flipped at the bird?
So I will give you some of the details. In some cases, again, there's anti-Semitism that can be very, very aggressive, and then there's some anti-Semitism that is passive anti-Semitism, where at times people may not even understand that what they're saying is anti-Semitic. I'll give you a couple of examples. One example, and I won't get into specific people or specific companies, and just it doesn't make any sense at the point to do that this one. It was my first week, I think, at a particular new job that I had, and I was at a client, a very large client, global client, and we were looking at, they were looking at creative, and this particular campaign focused on very unique and just long close-ups of people. And during the course of the discussion, one of the clients, not the agency person, but one of the clients who was going through the photos said, you know what, this is going to run in South America. This person looks too Jewish. Now, again, was that anti-Semitism? We're just recognizing the fact in this country that there is a large amount that they were talking about, that there was a large amount of anti-Semitism, and they were being a good marketer. From their perspective. But obviously, being young at the time, and someone who is of modern Orthodox and religious Judaism, it hurt. I had a first taste of what that could be from a creative perspective. I had a boss once who didn't have the best filter, and at one point, I forget the context of the discussion, so forgive me on that, but it was about the fact that, Jews all know each other because they all go to camp. There's an assumption because I didn't go to camp growing up, and so there was that. The next one was one where I hadn't even heard the term before, and I was in my, I guess, late 20s, early 30s, maybe. But I guess I was naive and kind of sheltered. But this guy who was a good person, he wasn't a bad person. He was actually having conversations with him, but he said, they're just trying to Jew us. Okay. And I actually had to look up what that meant. I didn't really know at the time what that was. But, was he anti-Semitic? Or was he using an anti-Semitic term that he grew up with by growing up in a particular part of the country? And I think that's part of it. And that's where, a lot of the DEI stuff has happened. I think that, because Jews have been somewhat successful, there have been plenty of CEOs in our industry who are Jewish, we've had successes in advertising, and so we don't necessarily have not looked in the past as anti-Semitism as a huge, huge problem. But it is, and especially if you are someone who's trying to adhere to certain aspects of our faith, it's a problem where you know that's sort of going in. And what I mean by that is this. One of the ways in an ad agency, and I can't speak for other parts of ad tech or whatever, but when you're trying to win new business and you have a major new business pitch, it's all hands on deck 24/7. The problem is, as a Sabbath observer, we're 24/6. And that can become a challenge because one of the top ways you advance in an ad agency is being part of and leading a new business team that wins a major account. And that is us. Because you're bringing a lot of money into the organization. And of course you're going to be rewarded by promotion and whatever if you achieve that. And that's the way it should be. But
do you think you've developed a radar? I mean, do you think you developed a radar to distinguish between genuine professional setbacks from those that are tinged with anti-Semitism? Like, you've ever had anyone cancel something, like a meeting, and you thought maybe it's because of me, or maybe it's because of anti-Semitism?
You know, I will say personally, I have not had an issue that I'm aware of overt anti-Semitism directly
right.
at me. Personally,
but
I don't
you've
think.
Had- But blatant anti-Semitism.
Covertly, I think there were some times on some of the business pitches where I was not asked to be part of it because
right.
they knew that from sundown Friday to sundown Saturday, I couldn't be there. I just couldn't. And they understood that. But I understood that. Now, is that anti-Semitism? No. I don't think, but is there, should there be some solutions for that? Should there be some discussion? Hey, how can you be as involved as you can be, knowing that we can't do that because, you know, we're rehearsing and, you know, the rehearsals that go on sometimes at midnight on Friday night. I get it. I understand that. But at the same time, there still needs to be a pathway to success because people who do observe a Sabbath or whatever other religious issue for whatever other type of religion you are, if you're being held back because of that, I think there needs to be discussions, more discussions openly about that. I do want to say one more thing about my fear currently about anti-Semitism in our industry. And it's a real fear. And it's more on the creative side of the industry than necessarily the media side. Creatives, thank God, will for many, many years, I don't believe, as I said, AI will be a tool that will replace them, come from various different backgrounds. And those backgrounds tend to lean more liberal, more progressive. And I think that not just in the advertising industry, but the entire world, as we've witnessed over the past few months, anti-Semitism has taken a large hole with those in the progressive and liberal left, far, far left. And again, not getting into politics about what you think or don't think about what's going on with the Israel-Gaza war. That's not what I'm talking about. But what I am talking about is the idea that for an industry that does lean heavily into creativity and the more liberal viewpoint, which is one kind of amazing, if the root of anti-Semitism starts to lean its way in there in any way, shape, or form, I'm concerned about that. And I hope and trust that DEI officials and senior executives at agencies are doing their best to counterbalance it. But that really opens up the question is to, while you want to solve DEI problems and be inclusive and share and be open, it's still a business. That stuff, to a large extent, as much as you can leave it at home, leave it at home. When you're working with somebody as a colleague, view them as a colleague and view them as a person, view them, whatever their beliefs are, as long as they keep it away and you're working together in the project and focusing know what you can do for your client, that to me is the most important thing. But if, and again, my concern of anti-Semitism on the far left continues, and that starts to impact it, I think that our industry will be one of the first to feel it.
So imagine a future free of such prejudice. What's one piece of advice you would give to the next generation of Jewish professionals stepping into the ad world, besides keep your head up and your bagel game strong?
Your head up and your bagel game, is that with a schmear, without a schmear?
What wisdom do we pass on, Jeff?
All right, I would say this.
I'm not implying you're going anywhere. I'm just, you know.
No, I'm not going anywhere. I have three daughters, did I mention that? I'm not going anywhere. My lesson is this. Be strong in your beliefs. Be cordial to others and strong and recognize that other people have beliefs as well. As I mentioned before, lean as much at home as you can, but don't be afraid to be who you are. But also be respectful. And remember that you're going to have to work twice as hard. You're going to have to put in more of the hours because there are times you won't be able there. And, you know, one of the biggest things I had to deal with that I, again, wasn't as anti-Semitic, and it was always said jokingly, oh, it's September, we'll see you in October, is when...
It's kind of true, though.
Yeah.
It's kind of true.
It is.
Let's be honest.
No, it is kind of true.
But I mean, it's a month-long holiday. I call it the month-long holiday.
Well, and that's why I breathe a sigh of relief when I see the calendar and I see that there are, you know, the holidays are on the weekends because at least right. that alleviates a lot of pressure. And understand that, yeah, it's true, but at the same time, the person that's running your business, whether it's a small business or whether it's a publicly traded holding company, whatever, they got deadlines. The deadlines are for clients and are for companies that have nothing to do with juice. Some might, some might not. But they, so understand that, you know, you're going to have to put in the effort. You're going to, the minute sundown happens, you're going to have to go online. You're going to have to be up till 3 a.m, catching up on things that you missed. That's part of the gig, and don't complain about it.
Sunday's my Monday.
Yeah.
That's absolutely the way it is. So, Jeff, if you had a time machine and you could beam yourself back to have a chat with little Jeff, fresh out of Yeshiva University, tie askew, what wisdom would you drop on him? And you can't say invest in Google. That's cheating.
Damn, that's where I was going with it. Okay, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but I will say this. You know, fortunate enough to have been in this industry at a time where a secondary degree to be successful wasn't a necessity.
Right.
But I certainly now, I believe it is something that's very valuable to have, especially with all the changes from a technological perspective. So all those reasons I gave before that I didn't go to law school, I would tell myself go to law school. And
right.
Yeah. You're going to do it anyhow. You're going to spend the hours. Life is not 9 to 5. And, you know, if you want to get ahead in the career, and you have to, you will be taken even more seriously. I think I've been taken pretty seriously in my career, and I appreciate that from the industry. But I think with a law degree in hand, more doors to work, things will open to you. And so I think, right. And I would say that a law degree over an MBA, simply just because I think that, again, opens more doors. But that's what I would say to little Duff. And I would say, take the money, invest in Facebook, invest in Microsoft and Google, and you'll be fine. And Apple.
So if a marketing genie came to your house and just gave you an offer, you could change one decision you made in your career, which epic fail would you make disappear? And everyone has a reply all disaster. I'm aware of that, yeah.
All right. So, no, it's not that. It's a career choice. And look, we have a saying that you're familiar with it, and that your viewers may not, Gamzela Tova. Even this is for the goal. And so I left Omnicom in 2015.
Right.
Not because I had any issue with Omnicom whatsoever. I love the people there and love my role there. And I was at the time, as I mentioned, was leading the charge on advanced seating at OTT. But a former client of mine had offered me an opportunity that I think or looked amazing. And
right.
Unfortunately, I took it. And Omnicom was very kind and tried to keep me, and I appreciated that very much. But I think it came down to 15 years of looking at the same bagels every morning. I just needed a new perspective and a new view. And unfortunately, that role, who a friend and who had become CMO of this organization, had recruited me. She was a former client and wanted to work with me again. And I always had a great working relationship with her. Unfortunately, that job blew up in my face. She was let go. And then a week later, I was let go. Not for anything I did. It was, I think, mostly budgetary reasons, as well as just directionally. I think this organization wasn't ready to move, even though I had interviewed them, told them my plans, to move at the pace that I wanted to move at. That changed the course of my career. Again, Gonzalo Tova, where I am today, having the opportunity to work with my mentor, Jack Myers, in Media Village for many, many years, and to be part of that, in addition to be able to sort of grow a consultancy a little bit on site, has been a wonderful experience and one that I cherish. But having said that, there was probably still more work to do at Omnicom, and I probably wish I could have gone back and changed that decision.
If you could have dinner with any fictional character, who would it be, and what's the burning question you would ask them? For example, Homer Simpson, you might ask about his secret to eternal youth.
Wow. Fictional character, what would I ask them? That's a tough one. I can't really, there's so many ones that are going through my mind right now. All right, I'll go Star Trek.
Okay.
I'll go Captain Kirk.
Is it the Green Women? Women?
How did you know? How did you know? That's exactly where I was going with it too. If it's not the Green Woman, I will say, why did you Captain Chuckley Wood as your last actor scene? So
was that Generations?
Generations, yeah.
Okay, wow.
I was going to say more like William, that's a real character.
What's the most unexpected thing you learned about yourself during a personality test? For example, that your spirit animal is a caffeinated squirrel.
I've taken a couple of personality tests. I don't think there was anything surprising.
I mean,
it did say, I'm a fan of, even before the Marvel movies, I was a fan of comic books or whatever. And I forget the name of the personality test, did say that I was very much into communicating through things like comics or things like that. And that didn't surprise me, but it is, I've always, one of the things I had it when I was at Ogilvy, I was a big fan of Xena, Warrior Princess. So I had a big carve-out of Xena, which obviously would not fly today, but I had a big carve-out of Xena because I wanted to intimidate all the sales reps. So I'm negotiating, I'm like, there's a Warrior Princess right behind me. So I'd love to go to Xena and...
Did you have a Kevin Sorbo also?
No, I did not have a Kevin Sorbo.
If you could choose a song to play every time you walked into a room, what would it be, and why would it be Never Gonna Give Up on You?
Only because who hasn't been rickled? The song is going to get everybody pumped every time. I mean,
right, you're Rocky?
You know, not that rocky. It's just it's.
Have you run up? Have you ever run up the stairs in Philadelphia?
I've sauntered. I've sauntered up the stairs.
You didn't run. You just...
I might have sauntered with my arms up and going like.
Everyone does it. Your secret weapon of choice in a zombie apocalypse. Why is it sarcasm?
I embrace zombies. Answered your question.
In an alternate universe, go ahead. In an alternate universe where you're famous for something completely outrageous, what would it be?
The best Beat Saber player in the world. Beat Saber, if you're not familiar, is a game in VR that is sort of like Guitar Hero with lightsabers. So, there you go.
If you were tasked for adding a new absurd category to the Olympics, what is it and how do you envision it going? For example, extreme ironing, because you can dodge a wrench, and you can if you could dodge a wrench, you can dodge a wrinkle. Oh, or synchronized solo dancing, be together alone.
Yeah, you could have given me these questions before.
This is not as fun then.
No, I know. Last, okay, calibrating. I'll keep it relevant to us.
Calibrating? Why?
Yeah, it's completely twisted.
Last but not least, what's the title of your unauthorized autobiography, and who would you fear would sue you?
The unauthorized, he should have taken a little bit, and I'll tell you why. Who would sue me? I'm not sure who would sue me, but, you know, my entire love of technology and my career path was started for my bar mitzvah when my grandfather, Olacham, the U.S. in peace, purchased an Apple II computer for me. Having said that, what I really wanted was a moped, and my career choices would have completely gone in a different direction had I had that moped. So I could have been, you know, Evel Knievel II, or, you know, some sort of, maybe in NASCAR at one point, or some or X Games or something like that. And so, you know, that would have been my alternate thing. And who would sue me? Anybody that I was driving in front of with them would probably have a right to sue me. So there's that.
What's Jeff Minsky's superpower?
I think professionally, my superpower has been one that I talk tech in English. Mm-hmm. I think that is a real superpower because in explaining new things to both internal audiences, constituencies, as well as clients and marketers, etc., I have the ability to take somewhat complicated concepts and bring them to a human English level. And the fact that I do think in a more practical perspective and certainly take the experiences that I've had in the industry and being able to really be in a unique spot to have seen and reviewed analytics and reporting across pretty much every major vertical, mm-hmm. to be able to translate that into a strategy that makes sense and is not just doing it for reasons that are not for the marketers today, I think that's a superpower.
And with that lively banter and profound reflection, we wrap up another insightful episode of the Adotat Show. It's been a roller coaster ride of insights with Jeff Minsky, covering everything from the nostalgic early days of ad tech to the cutting edge frontiers of VR and ethical AI. Thanks to Jeff for joining us and sharing his candid thoughts and stories, painting a vivid picture of an industry that's as dynamic as it is challenging. We'd also like to extend a big thank you to Troutman Amin LLP for sponsoring today's episode. Great attorneys, great advice. Until next time, stay curious, stay bold, and know more than you did yesterday.